and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine the status and prospects for healthcare reform in this election year as the Affordable Care Act is implemented across the country, with some states implementing it with enthusiasm and efficiency, and other states, thanks to the Supreme Court's decision, are refusing to expand Medicaid, thus denying millions of poor residents of their state's healthcare coverage at no expense to the state. Today we are broadcasting from the Families USA Healthcare Forum on Capitol Hill, where advocates of healthcare reform and activists across the country are engaged in trying to bring healthcare reform to their states will join us. And a familiar voice is joining us now to the listeners of Background Briefing, Wendell Potter, a former senior executive with both Aetna and Humana, is here. And Wendell, it's great to see you. And tell us about what's happening here today. The vice president is still speaking, and your sense of where we're heading in this election year, this political football that's been beaten up for so long. Do you think it's will continue to be a political football in this election year, or will the realities of its implementation trump the naysayers?
It's going to continue to be a political football. Those who are opposed to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare believe that they can continue to persuade people that it's not a good thing, and that they can, in certain districts and certain places of the country, build a winning campaign around that. So we're going to continue to see that. We've seen over the past 3 years now, a lot of misinformation about the Affordable Care Act by politicians who see some political gain from misinforming people. That will continue. It'll continue through the midterms, which will be at the end of this year in November of 2014. After that, I think we'll see it begin to diminish as a potent political issue.
And as a former insurance insider, what's your sense of where the insurance industry is on this? They, of course, stand to gain enormously from a new pool of insured that are being brought into the system who had previously been shut out. They seem to have been ambivalent. Here we are today where people from around the country who are trying to help with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act are meeting, and it's great to have access to so many people. That's why I'm here. But what's your sense of your former colleagues? Where do they stand?
They generally are supportive of this law because you're right. It does bring some new customers, new revenue that they can convert to profit if they manage it right. So they benefit financially, and you will see that they'll continue to support it. Now, that said, they don't like some of the consumer protections in the law. And they never have. So they will continue to try to whittle away at the things in the law that really protect us from abuses by the insurance industry. We're going to continue to see that, and they'll continue to support candidates who are opposed to the law, even though, ironically, the insurance industry supports it, because they think that if Republicans can take over Congress and the White House in 2016, then the chances of their being able to get what they want in terms of rolling back some of the consumer protections are enhanced.
So you think they're covering their bets?
Exactly. They always have. They always have done that. And I know from having worked in the industry and even managed the Political Action Committee for one of the big insurance companies, that's exactly what they always do. It's covering and hedging their bets.
So then what would the message be to voters in this election year?
To try to really seek out information that is reliable, that's hard to do. I wrote a book called Obamacare, What's in It for Me, and what Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act, just to lay out what really is true about the Affordable Care Act and how it affects every one of us. And I hope that people will get that. It's very cheap. You can get it as an e-book. But the point is, we need to educate ourselves about how the law does affect us. It affects every one of us, and in many important and beneficial ways that most of us never have heard about.
So what would your prediction be where we'll stand in late October of this year, a week or so before the elections?
I think in late October we'll be pretty much as we have been. We'll be confused. And this has been an issue that has polarized the country, and we'll continue to see that. People who are opposed to Obamacare will continue to be, and those who support it will continue to be supportive. The change, though, is beginning to take place because more and more people are actually benefiting. They're enrolling in coverage. So I think with every week that passes and every month that passes, more and more people will see how they are affected and how they're benefited from it.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who is the author of the new book, Obamacare, What's in It for Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. He's also the author of Deadly Spin, and he's a former senior executive with both Aetna and Humana Insurance. And joining us now is Gordon Bonneman, who is the attorney for the Tennessee Justice Center, and he's a former Families USA board member. I guess, what would you say the purpose of this gathering is, Gordon?
To inspire and coordinate and mobilize people from across the country who are advocating for health care reform.
Gordon, the South, of course, red state America, there's been enormous political resistance to the Affordable Care Act, the so-called Obamacare. And it's almost as if we have two Americas, not two echo an unfortunate political voice from the past. But what's your sense coming from the South about whether or not, because in California things are moving relatively well. The website's been up and running without any problems. Enrollment is up, but it's not the same, is it, across the country?
No, and it's heartbreaking. In Tennessee, an adjoining state, a neighboring state is Kentucky, and we have clients. I'm in a nonprofit law firm that serves low-income and uninsured families across our state. We have clients who are literally hundreds of yards from the Kentucky border, and if they lived on the other side of that border, they'd be getting health care now. But because they're in Tennessee and we're a very red state, they're getting nothing.
So how do the political leadership in these states get away with it, in effect? I mean, why punish their citizens because of the politicians' own ideological predilections?
Well, the polling data in Tennessee, and my understanding is it's true across the South, is that most people support expansion of Medicaid coverage and extension of health care coverage to the uninsured. They understand we're talking about working families that for whom it makes a huge difference. But it has to do with the dominance of the Republican Party and the internal dynamics in which the Tea Party turns out people for primaries, and that basically intimidates the more moderate leadership of the party into going along with extreme positions such as refusing to extend coverage to people who are working hard and need it.
So what could reverse this? I mean, one of the ways that it's people assume that it will cease being a political football and become a reality is that as it becomes a reality, the arguments against it are undercut by the fact that it's up and running. So when it's being prevented or sabotaged by the political authorities in the southern states, how do the public know? I mean, how do you get around that? Because, as I say, I've witnessed firsthand in California, even relatives of mine signing up and suddenly saying, my God, I'm saving $1,000 a month.
Right.
I mean, if that were happening in your state, Tennessee, we wouldn't have a problem, right?
We wouldn't. I think people don't realize, including in those red states, that you can't maintain the status quo. Either the healthcare system is going to move backwards, fall backwards and decline, or it's going to move forward with the embrace of reform. By that, I mean specifically, there are changes coming in the Affordable Care Act to hold hospitals more accountable for the quality of care, to realize savings in Medicare and Medicaid payments. Those are all predicated on the assumption that more people are going to be covered. So even though hospitals will see a reduction in their Medicare rates, they'll make it up in providing services for people who now have a source of pay. What that means is that in states like Tennessee that adamantly refuse to expand Medicaid, those billions a year that were to come into the healthcare system won't, And we're looking at the closure of hospitals on an enormous scale across our state. I think when that starts happening, people are going to take a second look, because that affects everybody, regardless of their political affiliation.
And again, I'm speaking with Gordon Bonneman, who's an attorney with the Tennessee Justice Center. So, Gordon, in the meantime, in the short time, in order to alleviate some of the pain, is there anything that can be done in terms of information and education? I mean, are you living in a media bubble down there? Is it not possible for people, for the truth to sort of seep from across the border from Kentucky?
Well, actually, much of the news media, local news media, is covering what's going on, and there's a good bit of indignation, particularly in rural communities that are facing the loss of their hospitals. So it's going to be interesting how it plays out over the next couple of years. Right now we're in a primary season in which the Republican Party, because the Republican Party dominates and the Democratic Party is almost a spent force in our state, you have all these dynamics between the Tea Party and the more moderate wing of the party. And until we're past that, the expectation is that nothing's going to happen, because no one wants to alienate the Tea Party base. But the expectation, too, is that at some point these chickens are going to come home to roost, and the practical realities of closing hospitals, lost jobs, and competitive disadvantage with other states, never mind what happens to low-income working people, just those economic realities are going to force a moment of truth.
Well, Gordon Bonneman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gordon Bonneman, who's an attorney with the Tennessee Justice Center. And joining us now is Max Rickman, who is the National with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Rickman.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Max, your organization, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, I guess you're doing the Lord's work, given that there's this sort of jihad been going on now for decades and intensifying, to basically take away the two pillars of what arguably are the remnants of social democracy in the United States. Why is it that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it? Why is it, do you think, that people are trying to destroy these programs?
Well, I think it all, as with many things, comes down to money. These programs, particularly Social Security, are extremely successful, with respect to Social Security, has been able to stockpile, if you will, about $2.7 trillion by design. That's how much money was paid in through the payroll tax above what has been paid out in benefits. And that surplus trust fund, if you will, was created to be there when the baby boomers now have just started in the last year or so entering retirement. It's a tempting amount of money. And it should not be misused for dealing with issues involving our federal debt. Remember the fiscal cliff a year ago, and how there was an effort to drag Social Security into that discussion. Whatever is done with Social Security, and it's a dynamic program, it changes, has changed over time, over the last 80 years or so, and will continue to change. But the changes to Social Security should be done for the sake of the program, not to address other financial problems that our federal government is facing.
Well, isn't there an object lesson in what happened under President George W. Bush, who tried to privatize it and didn't succeed? But had he succeeded and had people drunk the Kool-Aid that he'd be better off, you know, investing in private health insurance on Wall Street rather than this program that's been working for decades, what would have happened to those people after the 2008 crash?
Yeah, I'll tell you, what I started referring to my 401k at that time as my 201k, because half the value disappeared. Social Security was not impacted in that way. It was sound. People continued to receive all the benefits that they're entitled to in full, with the cost of living adjustment, inadequate in my opinion, but still a cost of living adjustment each year. If that money, God forbid, had been invested in the stock market, or part of it, as President Bush proposed, Social Security recipients would have suffered. So I'm hoping that was an object lesson. There isn't that much talk about privatizing the program. I think people realize that that was not, there was not much success in that effort. But there's still a lot of discussion of reducing benefits by virtue of lowering the cost of living adjustment. That's one approach. Raising the retirement age.
The chain CPI you're talking about?
The chain CPI. You obviously have done your homework. The chain CPI is an effort to change the formula by which the COLA is calculated. And unfortunately, it has been proposed by the president in the last couple of budgets. I think that is misguided. He has not succeeded in getting that through the Congress, and I'm hoping that there's enough opposition that if it is in his budget, which we'll see in about a few weeks, that it will face a strong opposition again this year, as it did in the past.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Rickman, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Why is it then that chain CPI is getting some political traction and not the easiest fix, which is what Senator Bernie Sanders and others have suggested, which is just to raise the cap? There's no reason why multimillionaires and billionaires should be paying the same amount that regular folks are paying.
Well, I think that's getting traction. I think more and more people are, first of all, becoming aware that there is a cap. I bring this up often at town hall meetings, and I've conducted hundreds of them with members of Congress, including Senator Sanders, in their home districts and states. A lot of people don't even know there's a cap on the amount of wages subject to the payroll tax. Why? They never reach that cap, so they just assume you pay on all your wages. I've heard people describe this cap as a loophole. Why should someone who's making $1 million, $5 million a year not pay a little bit more in Social Security? Maybe the percentage would be different. Depends on what the politics are. I think one of the proposals, I believe it's Senator Sanders, would start the payroll tax again at, I think, $250 or $300. So there's politically, that might be easier to move through the Congress than just eliminating it altogether. But we support what we call scrapping the cap. It would bring more revenue into the program and not affect beneficiaries.
So here today at this meeting for advocates of health care reform and those trying to implement it in the states, and of course it's being done unevenly because of the ideological objections on the part of a number of southern governors, for example. What's your sense then in terms of your issue, which is preserving Social Security and Medicare, in terms of this launch of the Affordable Care Act? Has this been a blow to those who advocate that the government can get things done?
It's been a setback. There's no doubt about it. And I think even the administration, the president, admits that there were problems with the launch. I think those are being corrected rapidly. And I think when we look back on this episode in a few years from now, it'll be the Affordable Care Act will become as much a part of our social fabric as Social Security and as Medicare. By the way, the Affordable Care Act was a real plus for Medicare beneficiaries. Regardless of the launch, the problems with the rollout and the computer problems with signing up, the Affordable Care Act, the bottom line is, if you're on Medicare, the Affordable Care Act means you get more benefits and pay less for them. the Affordable Care Act, for the first time ever under Medicare, provides preventative care such as mammograms, colonoscopies, diabetes screening for Medicare beneficiaries with no out-of-pocket cost. That's a real plus. That will improve health care in the long run, a lower cost, and save lives. It closes, the Affordable Care Act closes the donut hole in the prescription drug Part D portion of Medicare. And the Affordable Care Act extends the solvency of the Medicare program by 7 years. So despite all the rhetoric and scare tactics in the last couple of elections about $716 billion being taken from the Medicare program, those reductions, those savings did not come out of beneficiaries. They came out of reimbursement rates to a whole variety of providers. That's where that money came from. But the impression among the public was it's got to hurt because they just took $716 billion out of Medicare. It did not hurt beneficiaries. As I said, the best way I've found to explain it is under the Affordable Care Act, if you're on Medicare, you get more in terms of benefits and you pay less for those benefits.
Well, Max Rickman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Rickman, who is with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more from Families USA's Healthcare Action Forum on Capitol Hill.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we've got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor,
and welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing from Capitol Hill today in Washington, D.C. And joining us now is Cy Lazarus, who is with the Constitutional Accountability Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cy Lazarus.
Nice to be here.
And what's the Constitutional Accountability Center's role in trying to implement the Affordable Care Act, given the Supreme Court has basically made its ruling? It was a mixed blessing. It clearly, the core of Obamacare survived, but the fact that they allowed the decisions allowed the states to do what they're doing now, I think, has had terrible ramifications. It's quite manifest. I'm from the state of California, where Affordable Care Act is being implemented with enthusiasm and efficiency, but in places like Texas, it's dead on arrival. So let's talk about the Supreme Court's decision. What's your feelings about it?
Well, first of all, on your first question about what's the Constitutional Accountability Center's role, our role has been to stress that the Constitution, as written, and the vision of the framers strongly supported the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act and of strong humanitarian measures taken by the federal government. You know, contrary to what the right constantly says, the framers did not imagine a small government constitution in a blinkered fashion. They actually wanted an effective federal government. That was probably the most important objective they had when they wanted to junk the Articles of Confederation and create the government that we now have. So that's what our role has been. You're asking what my view of the Supreme Court's decision a year and a half ago. You're right, it was a mixed blessing. Certainly, the blessings were mainly positive, namely the Affordable Care Act was almost entirely upheld. There were definitely some gestures in the direction of I would say, libertarian misconceptions about limitations on federal authority that are sprinkled through the decision, the majority decision, and particularly in the incredibly virulent right-wing dissent of four justices who are four justices and therefore need only one more to be a majority. All those things are matters for ongoing concern. But basically, the act is constitutional, and we won.
So what is then the explanation for the rejection of it by other states? I mean, in terms of what is their constitutional legal basis? Are they basically, is this a states' rights argument?
Well, there are two parts of this. First of all, the Affordable Care Act is seeking to expand the number of people who are covered by insurance through two means. One is by enabling sort of lower lower income people, middle lower income people, to get cheaper and better opportunities for insurance on exchanges, which are marketplaces in the states, so they can have the same ability to pool their risks that people who work for large employers do. The act said the state should set up exchanges, but then it said that if they don't, the federal government will set up exchanges and operate the exchanges for them. So that's actually what's happening. The states are trying. The Republican reactionary states aren't doing anything to cooperate with the federal government to set these exchanges up, but they can be set up, and they will, and they are being set up. There's a limited degree to which the recalcitrant right in red states can frustrate the implementation of exchanges, at least if one of their legal challenges to the way it's being implemented don't succeed, which I don't think they will. With respect to Medicaid, unfortunately, the Supreme Court's decision does give states the practical ability to opt out of the Medicaid expansion, and red states have done that, and even purple states Republicans are in power in legislatures and state houses under pressure from their right wing have, incredibly enough, forced the state to reject the large federal funding that's available to aid the people who would be newly eligible for Medicaid. I think that is very unfortunate, and I think that over time it probably will end, because I think that people in the states will begin to see that their neighbors are getting benefits that they're not getting, and the political pressures will mount to change.
And again, I'm speaking with Cy Lathrus, who's with the Constitutional Accountability Center. So this country and its constitution is founded upon the principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So given those three, life, of course, is intimately involved with health care. That's health care keeps you alive. And the pursuit of happiness, you know, you can't pursue happiness if you're sick. So the third pillar, liberty, maybe that gives the opponent some traction, the libertarians, because they think that somehow big government is imposing on their right not to have health care, which is something that's hard to get your head around. But
just say one thing, you know, that's because they take an absurdly narrow definition of what liberty is. Liberty is not just a negative, don't leave me alone. If you don't have access to adequate health care, you don't effectively have liberty. So the fact is that providing health care, as the Affordable Care Act does, is actually a very significant boon to liberty for 99% of people who are not right-wing ideologues.
Well, I guess my point, Cy, is that you've got two out of three at the very least. So surely your side should be winning the argument.
Because we have two out of three. Yes, our side should be winning the argument. I completely agree with that.
And do you think?
In fact, I think we have three out of three.
Right. So do you think you will win the argument?
Well, we won the argument on the constitutionality of the law.
But what about in this election year?
Oh.
If the Republicans take over the Senate and maintain their majority in the House or even increase it, I think Affordable Care Act's in for a bad time, and President Obama will be a lame duck.
Yes, he will be. He still have veto power, and a Democratic minority in the Senate would have a lot of ability to block measures that would completely repeal or effectively gut the Affordable Care Act. And in addition to that, you know, important parts of the Affordable Care Act are actually popular. Large majorities think it's important to ensure that people with pre-existing medical conditions can get access to health care in both parties. There isn't a broad understanding that you can't really do that in an economical way and make health insurance affordable if there isn't some kind of mandate to ensure that that everyone is in it together. So I think if there are serious efforts to change this law, rationality may set in, and those efforts may have to get pushed back.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Cy Lazarus.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Cy Lazarus, who's with the Constitutional Accountability Center. And joining me now is John Ahrensmeyer, who is the founder and CEO of Small Business Majority. Welcome to Background Briefing, John.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And, John, you, in many ways, the small business arena is where the rubber meets the road in terms of this arguments for and against the Affordable Care Act. Conservatives have suggested, although your opponents have suggested, that this is a burden for small business, and advocates, of course, are saying no. In fact, it's a boon for small business. So give us some clarity here, if you will.
Well, the starting point for all of this is that the previous system was completely unsustainable. Small businesses were seeing double, sometimes triple-digit increases, and the fact that there were pre-existing condition prohibitions to getting coverage meant that people who wanted to start small businesses often couldn't do so if they were worried about not being able to get coverage. So we had a completely unsustainable system that was actually discouraging entrepreneurship. So much about the new law is really, as you say, a boon to small business, and very little is a burden. Unfortunately, there's been so much more heat than light shown on this over the last 4 years that a lot of what's in the law still isn't properly understood, and we're dealing with a lot of confusion out there. I mean, we've been doing scientific polling of small businesses, not just of our members, but of all small businesses for years about health care, and we talk to small businesses every day. We now have a network of 25,000 small businesses of our own and an extended network of 400,000 through our strategic partners. And we find that when they learn what is in the law, they're very happy. They love the fact that there are now competitive marketplaces where they can purchase coverage, where they can pool together, so they have the power of a large business now, and purchase coverage with plans that are competing with each other. They love the fact that the pre-existing condition rules no longer exist. They love the fact that there are tax credits available. And they love the fact that there are cost containment provisions in the law. And, in fact, they're already seeing that the increase in their costs are coming down. So, and what's really a misstated fact is that 96% of all small businesses have under 50 employees. So they have no additional obligation to provide coverage. For businesses over 50 employees, that there is a requirement that they provide coverage, 95% of those already offer. So you have a really small percentage of a small percentage that has an additional requirement that they don't now. For most small businesses, they're just more options. They can still buy on the outside market. They can buy from the marketplaces and pool together. So they are seeing costs coming down. Our biggest battle right now is the confusion out there and the need to educate not only small business owners but also brokers and agents with whom they work about the new law and about the new options.
Well, I recall a number of years ago that the big three in Detroit were starting to move a lot of their plants into Canada because the Canadians have health care, because their health and pension obligations were absolutely crippling. Right. And, you know, many of them went through bankruptcy. So does that argument apply here? In other words, I've never understood why the business community in this country hasn't been all for a form of affordable health for American citizens, because it seems to me if you take that off the table for businessmen, they can get on with their business and not be in the health insurance business.
Well, exactly. I mean, the costs are unsustainable. The fact that businesses have to spend time worrying about these options takes them away, as you say, from running their businesses. And we do have a competitive disadvantage around the world by having much higher health care costs than other countries. So,
by the way, let's just pin that down. A lot of the rest of the developed world has 6, 7, 8% of GDP in terms of healthcare costs. Right. We're up to 18%.
Right.
So it's really out of whack.
It's a real burden. And all the polling we did of small businesses leading up to the passage of the law, they said healthcare was their single biggest problem. The need to provide it for themselves and their families, the desire. Most small businesses want their employees to have health coverage. And the reason we found that they didn't offer it, for those who didn't offer, 86% of them said it was because of cost. So it wasn't because they didn't want to have a good health care for themselves and for their employees. It was simply because of the cost that they couldn't afford it. And so, you know, we had a system that we all can all agree was completely unsustainable. And we have a law, while not perfect, that has taken major steps to address cost, coverage, accessibility, remove some of the barriers to entrepreneurship that the previous healthcare system was creating. And look, I mean, the biggest challenge right now is that you're implementing something that's huge. You know, there are a lot of moving parts. There have obviously been some glitches. And not all of the provisions that relate to small business are up and running yet. The federally run exchanges don't have online sign up yet for small businesses. The states that are running them, this has been slow to come on board. So we have, you know, a couple years of work to continue to educate and get people to understand what their options are. But we have seen every step along the way in this process, we've found that small businesses, once they understand what the new options are, once they understand the fact that their costs are going to come down over time, there's been actually a lot of excitement.
So, John Ahrensmeyer, again, the founder and CEO of the Small Business Majority. When do you think this will stop being a political football and become a reality?
Well, we're not in the political prognostication business, but I would hope. I mean, we're seeing some signs now that it's less of one. The U.S. Chamber actually officially said that they no longer are opposing the law. They're more about figuring out how to implement it. I think the reality is, in this political cycle, it's still going to be a bit of a political football. I hope that's not the case, but I think it will be. I do think that after the 2014 elections, we're going to be so far into having this law implemented. And I don't think it's going to, and again, we're not in the political prognostication business, I don't think it's going to play out the same way it did in 2010. And I think I'm really hopeful that certainly by next year, we'll all be coming together, Democrats and Republicans, and saying, let's make this work. If we need to make fixes, fine. But let's stop talking about it going away, because it's not going away.
So just in closing, in your discussions with fellow businessmen, small or large, when you said that our lack of affordable care in this country and rational health care has been a burden on business and has affected our competitive advantages vis-a-vis our overseas rivals. How does that resonate, that argument? You would think that...
It does resonate. I mean, small business owners are very aware of where they fit into the economic fabric, and we see ourselves as being, you know, we're 50% of the economy. We feel sometimes our voices aren't being heard. And in this area, I mean, small businesses have traditionally paid 18% more for covers than big businesses. So while, as you completely are correct, this has been a problem for big businesses, it's been a bigger problem for small businesses. And I know the small businesses, we talk to them every day, feel that it's a competitive disadvantage that they have these costs and burdens. So they welcome change, but, you know, because of all of the sort of noise around this, it's been complicated and difficult for them to really fully understand what their options are. And I think we're going to see that dissipate over time as we just move forward, put our heads down, get people educated, get people to understand what they need to do, and I think we'll be fine.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today on Background Briefing, John Ahrensmeyer.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with John Ahrensmeyer, who is the founder and CEO of the Small Business Majority. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more coverage from the Families USA Health Action 2014 Forum on Capitol Hill. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mona Mangat, who is the chair of Doctors for America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mona Mangat.
Thank you so much for having me.
And clearly America needs doctors, and apparently rural America needs them more. So what's the – just give me an idea of what Doctors for America are about.
We are a national organization. We have over 16,000 physician and medical student members in all 50 states, and we are trying to advocate for the creation of a better healthcare system, one where every person has access to high-quality and affordable healthcare.
So what's your sense then of where we stand with the Affordable Care Act? Because a lot of people thought we should adopt what most other countries have, which is some form of single payer. And then others suggested maybe just, you know, expanding Medicare, which works well. So, but we've ended up with this insurance-based model.
And your term "we ended up with" is exactly what it is. You know, that whole process was quite a difficult one, and I think we ended up with what was politically feasible at the time. Doctors for America sees the Affordable Care Act as an incredible opportunity. It does not see it as the panacea for all our problems, an opportunity to really start to create the kind of change that we want. We definitely see enrollment as, or at least access to care, as one of the most critical pieces of this, and that's why we're working very hard to ensure that everyone has access to health insurance.
So one of the arguments for healthcare reform has been the fact that the U.S. spends more than any other developed country and has the worst outcomes. We're up to about 18% of our GDP. Other countries, I think Israel's around 7%, and the European countries tend to be around 8 or 9%. So we're doubling the costs with the worst outcomes. Does that argument resonate? You would think it would resonate with conservatives, for example, business-minded people, that it's just, you know, they're the ones, after all, who keep telling us the sky is falling because of the deficit.
I actually think that this speaks and really bothers people, especially in terms of American exceptionalism. I think people don't like to hear that we're not the best, that we spend the most money, we don't have the best outcomes. But the numbers are the numbers. I think if you have some rare disease or very complex disease, then you'll be lucky to be in the United States. But if you have run-of-the-mill diabetes, high blood pressure, asthma, and you don't have access to health care, then you're not going to do very well in the United States. So this is an argument that resonates deeply with me and many of our members.
Well, what about another argument? Because this is we're in the land of speculation here, and it's probably a luxury you can't afford. But on the other hand, my understanding about medicine in general is that prevention, clinics, outpatient type operations for basic screening for basic problems that most people have is infinitely cheaper than any other system. And at the end of the day, you pick up stuff early so you don't have the catastrophic costs when things have gone too far. Why isn't there a move in that direction as opposed to bigger hospitals, bigger health plans, bigger providers?
You are correct that primary care is really the basis of all this. If we can't really prevent disease, then we waste a lot of money and a lot of quality of life trying to treat end stages of diseases. This law does a lot to speak towards prevention. All of these basic preventive services are now covered with no cost sharing under these new health insurance plans that are being sold, as well as through Medicare. So that means your annual exam, your mammogram, your colonoscopy, all these things that work to try to keep you healthy are now, there's no cost barrier for that. So that it should incentivize people to do that sort of thing. One of the other problems is that there's a perverse payment system in the United States where, you know, spending half an hour with a patient talking about exercise and diet is not reimbursed the same way that, you know, doing a procedure is, or, you know, putting a cardiac stent after they've had, you know, coronary artery disease. So there needs to be a lot of discussions and conversations that we have about how we incentivize payment in this country, how we pay for care, and how we deliver it. So I think that we are really changing the conversation now and really going to talk about things that matter. And specifically, the National Prevention Council was formed several years ago. And if you've been following it, there is always a charge to raid the National Prevention Fund because there is not a great deal of respect given to that idea of prevention. Probably also because the gratification is very delayed. You don't see an immediate result. This is a sort of long game view, which is hard for many people to have, especially in Washington.
So, in other words, you know, in terms of the famous bedside manner, what you're telling us is that the present system doesn't allow for a bedside manner, for the kind of discussions between a patient and their doctor about the holistic nature of this person and their needs. It's in and out. You know, you barely meet the person before they do an expensive procedure.
Right. I mean, that's the way this system is set up. The more patients you see, the more money you make, the more you bill, the more you make. It's not about quality. It's not about spending time. And that's something that, you know, obviously has not been working out very well for the healthcare system.
Well, as the chair of Doctors for America, what do you discover when you travel around the country talking to your colleagues? Are they, you know, happy to make all this money, or are there many who are more, you know, connected with the spirit of the Hippocratic Oath, if you will?
Well, I think that most people that went into medicine must have had some sort of desire to do it that went beyond money, because if you wanted to make a lot of money quickly, there were a lot of better ways to do that. And so I see, when I speak to my colleagues, a lot of hope and a lot of optimism that this is an opportunity for us to create the kind of healthcare system where good care and good quality of life and a lot of focus on prevention is what's focused on. So I actually see, I feel very hopeful as we move forward, especially when I look at my colleagues.
Well, Mona Mungert, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you so much for having me. The pleasure is mine.
Again, I've been speaking with Mona Mungert, MD, who is the chair of Doctors for America. And joining us now is Eleanor Clift, who's a contributing editor to The Daily Beast. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eleanor Clift.
Glad to be with you.
And Eleanor, let's talk about the politics, since the Affordable Care Act, of course, we saw the torturous travails of the sausage making as it went through the legislative process, and then it went through the legal process with a Supreme Court ruling that's ambivalent. It's this allowing states to deny the expansion of Medicaid, which is in itself an extraordinary thing. Is this really a case where governors, for ideological reasons, are denying health care to their fellow Americans?
Well, you can certainly put it that way. They, of course, I'm sure, would dress it up and say that their state can deliver health care more effectively. They don't want to rely on the federal government, even though the federal government pays well over 90% of the cost. After the initial couple of years, they worry that the state will have to pick up the cost and they can't sustain that. So they have arguments. But I suspect eventually the pressure from within their states will be so great that they will capitulate. And you've seen that in some instances. John Kasich in Ohio, notably, he basically cited his Roman Catholic beliefs and social justice that he could not stand by and deny his constituents these needed services. And you have Jan Brewer in Arizona, Republican, who basically waged a campaign to convince her legislature to support the expansion of Medicare. And she brought in the business community and the hospitals. And I think what you're going to see in these other states is that the hospital community, which in this country you have to provide care if somebody shows up, and if they're not covered, they can't pay. And so there's all this uncompensated care, which is what the Affordable Care Act is supposed to address. If you leave Medicaid out of the mix and all the people that program would serve, you're back in the same problem. So those people, they sit on boards, they're prominent in the community. I think pressure will be on these governors, and at some point the ideological lift may not be as heavy for them as it appears to be today.
I was talking earlier with Wendell Potter, who comes out of the insurance business as a PR man and knows it intimately, and I asked him about this election year, whether this issue that's been a political football for so long with this Republican jihad against it, how do the insurance companies feel about it? Because obviously it's opening them up to a lot more customers. And he suggested that they were kind of hedging their bets. They were supporting it in the short term, but in the long term they probably prefer a Republican Senate and a Republican House, making Obama a lame duck, and that way they not so much get rid of it, but they would be able to take out of it the things that that are the actual improvements.
Right. But if you take the things out that are the actual improvements, insurance is pooled risk. So if you take out what some people claim they don't like and don't want to pay for, that then the whole thing collapses. So I'm not sure that kind of picking and choosing is an option. And maybe they'll get a Republican Senate this November, but the earliest they can get a Republican president is November of 2016. And I think the law as is will be pretty well embedded. I don't see any wholesale changes.
Well, but clearly, at least one would assume that since the Republicans have been so obsessed with trying to kill this for so long, it's likely to be an election year issue for them. And do you think that, conversely, the Democrats, who have often expressed ambivalence, and particularly when the healthcare website crashed, they were running for the hills, are they going to be robust in its defense?
Well, I think you're talking now about 2014, November
sure.
of this year.
Yeah.
And I think right now what you just said is the absolute truth. The Republicans see it as a big issue and Democrats are scared. But there could be a couple of more turns of the screw before we get to November. And I think even the Democrats who are worried about it, they're not going to abandon it completely. I don't think they're going to say, I wish I never voted for it. I was against it before I was for it or anything like that. They will campaign on, if there are problems and we identify them, let's fix them. And I think the White House is going to ramp up a more aggressive effort to showcase the positive attributes of the law. As we come to the end of the enrollment period, I think the numbers, they may fall short of what the initial predictions, but I think they're going to be robust enough that it's clear the law is not going anywhere. So I think if the Republicans just bank on campaigning against Obamacare without offering an alternative, that it's not going to carry them very far. Word is that, Paul Ryan, former vice presidential candidate, and others are actually going to put forward some sort of a plan. But I don't know what that could be, because Obamacare basically borrows all the Republican ideas. Keep the insurance companies in the mix, have an individual mandate so people can demonstrate personal responsibility. I think to now come out and say, well, we think you should be able to sell insurance across state lines and you should be able to have, individual policies, I don't think that doesn't have heft as an alternative to the Affordable Care Act.
But isn't one of the problems with our politics are that one party, which is essentially a minority party, is able to get everybody, every last one of their members, the Republicans, to come out to vote. And the Democrats, who are a natural majority, often don't inspire their people to come out to vote. Mm-hmm. And if you look at 2008, 140 million people voted, and it was Obama and the Democrats were swept in. 2 years later, about half of that, 75 million, voted, and it was a blowout for the Republicans. And obviously, cleverly planned, it was a census year. They were able to establish a considerable amount of gerrymandering in key Republican states where they control the governorship. So I imagine in 2014, they'll come back with an even better operation than Karl Rove's very successful one in 2010. So to my mind, unless President Obama and the Democrats treat this as a presidential election year and pull out all the stops, they could be in trouble.
Well, I agree with you. There's always a huge fall off when it's not a presidential year. I don't know that Karl Rove had a big plan in 2010. I think basically the Republicans profited because the Democrats didn't come out, and it was a smaller, whiter electorate. You know, Karl Rove's turnout plan worked beautifully in 2004, but he's not even much of a player anymore.
Well,
he had all that money.
He turned out a lot of money.
He didn't have many victories to show for it. But, you know, the Obama side of the equation, they have OFA organized for...
I know. I get nothing but emails
right,
from them.
Exactly. And they want to raise money and all that. And, you know, I worry about the fact that there doesn't seem to be much of a ground operation being put in place for 14.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Obama, if he had not taken his eye off the ball in 2010 and let the whole anti-health care thing overwhelm the agenda, the Tea Party emerge, he would be looking at a very different presidency than he is today. So I think it's been driven home how important these midterm elections are. And I think the, you know, president's going to be out there campaigning and raising money for the committees, campaigning that a lot of Democrats don't want to campaign with him, but he's going to be focusing on some of the gubernatorial races, particularly Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, because if they can get them back in the Democratic column, that would have some significant impact in 2016.
Right.
You know, but you're right. I mean, typically campaign operatives don't focus on turnout in these off-year elections, and the turnout is abysmal.
Right.
Plus, you have pretty concerted Republican effort on voter suppression, making it harder for people to vote. You got to have the right ID, and they cut back the early voting and the hours and all of that. So, yeah, I mean, Democrats have a lot to worry about this year.
I mean, he would be a lame duck, wouldn't he, if he lost the Senate?
Oh, if he lost the Senate, that would really be very, very easily. He's a lame duck almost anyway.
Right.
But without the Senate, that would be a very unhappy last 2 years of his presidency. That's right. He'd just be basically blocking and tackling.
Well, Eleanor Clift, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Eleanor Clift, who's a contributing editor to The Daily Beast. And again, broadcasting today from Washington, D.C., this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.